facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Ah, like Michael Jordan said when he returned to the NBA in 1995, I'm back. Just a two-word press release. And I am back on The Cale Clark Show for another year, 2022. Glad to be sharing it with you. Call me right now, 1-888-914-9149. It's a toll-free line to call for free to talk to me. I'm into the rhyming thing. I should have been a rapper. You should have played some Eminem for me, Lucas. Guess who's back?
Or I could have played some Taylor Swift's. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling 2022.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Lucas. Likewise. And everybody can call in to that number once again, toll free, 888-914-9149. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can hit me up on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account, a.k.a. the producer Lucas shadow account. Because he was shadow banned. The truth is he was shadow banned from Twitter. He was kicked out like so many have been. So he is hiding
speaking
behind the show account.
Speaking too much truth, what can I say?
Speaking truth to power. At Cale Clark Show is the show handle. So it's another good account to follow because we very often do polls. You can put out questions there and get a message to producer Lucas that way. Because he never answers his email, I gotta tell you. No, that's not true. He's very responsible. So Lucas, I gotta ask you, how was your Christmas break?
It was good. Yeah, very restful. Watched some football, made some food, enjoyed time with family. So yeah, it was pretty chill, but it was good, restful.
Wow,
so,
wow.
Yeah, how about you?
I guess if you watched football, then I can truly say that the Dolphins made you cry.
Yeah,
just like
it's a little too soon to be honest, but I do owe you a congratulations because the Bills clinched a playoff spot.
Thank you. I had much to do with it other than that I did sit out in the cold for one game and froze my butt off for the cause. But yes, the Bills are in the playoffs, so lots of exciting things happening in 2022. And let me ask you this, Lucas, did you watch, it's kind of a Christmas tradition in my household, did you watch A Charlie Brown Christmas this year?
You know what? It actually was a family tradition of mine growing up, but I actually missed it this year.
Well, it's always a classic. I love A Charlie Brown Christmas. Who doesn't? And The Atlantic, that erstwhile magazine, published a really interesting piece on the best way I can describe this is the interior spiritual life of Charlie Brown. Now, that might sound ridiculous to you, but there are a lot of spiritual lessons that you can learn from A Charlie Brown Christmas, which are very applicable to us in this day and age. And I learned some things that I didn't know about the creator of the Peanuts comic strip and, of course, the television shows and everything else that followed, Charles Schulz, the late Charles Schulz, who died in the year 2000, 22 years ago. So Caitlin Flanagan wrote this piece called Charlie Brown's Inside Job for The Atlantic magazine. I don't know if you saw this, if anybody reads The Atlantic, but it was actually a really interesting piece. And it's really, the article is really all about that moment in A Charlie Brown Christmas when Linus says, "Lights, please." And then he recites, of course, the Christmas story from the Gospel of Luke in the King James translation. That's the sort of the centerpiece of the show. It's really the climax of the show, the Christmas play that Charlie Brown is trying to put on. And anyways, I think it's just a really interesting piece. And Caitlin Flanagan was saying in the article that her parents were atheists and she didn't know anything about Christianity growing up, but she was sent to Catholic school when she was in grade 6. And that was how she kind of got the lingo and learned the lay of the land, so to speak. And her parents, apparently, especially her mother, worked very hard to keep Caitlin and her sister very free from religion, especially Christianity. But as she says in the piece, we did have our gods, Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. They reigned over us with great kindness and generosity. And if we had any kind of crisis of faith, we always dealt with it privately on our own. And she said that her sister and she understood that their feelings about Christmas were very important to their parents. And apparently her parents had really bad childhoods, but they didn't try to get any help for their struggles. They didn't see any counseling or anything like that. they just tried to create the perfect Christmas for their kids. And Caitlin says that it was a very wonderful time of the year, but it's also a really intense and tense time of the year. And maybe you can relate, having just come out of the holiday season, and obviously with everything that's going on, with the Omicron variant spreading, as if the holidays aren't stressful enough. They're very restful and relaxing for a lot of people. A lot of people can't get enough of it, but for others, it's a pretty stressful time. Not only do you have to deal with a lot of demands on your time that you don't normally, some people don't get a chance to relax with all the commitments, friends, family, and everything like that. They don't actually get to have what we talked about in the show a lot on the Cale Clark Show last year, this idea of high quality leisure. If you don't have high quality leisure, you're not going to be rested to work really well. So, and everyone's getting their credit card bills right now. I always think it's interesting how the day after Christmas, which, you know, in the secular world is Boxing Day, everyone's looking for the bargains, spending more money. Boxing Day, December the 26th, it's the feast of the first Christian martyr, St. Stephen. Now, this year it was superseded, of course, because it fell on a Sunday. But I always found it very intriguing that the first martyr's feast day comes the day after Christmas. The day after Christmas. It reminds us that there is a cost to Christmas. There is a cost to following Jesus. It's going to cost you your life. And there's also a cost to the secular Christmas as well, in that you're going to get that credit card bill at the end of the month. So that's something that a lot of people dread. But in this article in The Atlantic, Caitlin Flanagan talks about how watching a Charlie Brown Christmas growing up actually helped her to figure out how Christianity worked. And when it came out, it was back in the year 1965, and Peanuts, the famous cartoon strip, was syndicated to hundreds of newspapers in the United States, created, of course, by the late Charles Schulz, Snoopy, Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, all the gang, Schroeder. That was really at the time when it was at the height of its popularity. It was the characters of Peanuts were on the cover of Time magazine in the spring of 1965. So many millions of children loved it because they didn't have the distractions that kids have today. There are really only a few sources where you could get media. And cartoon newspaper strips are really, really popular with kids. Same with television. There were only three choices at the time. Does anybody remember that? It was a simpler time, wasn't it? NBC, CBS, ABC, that was it. And as Flanagan writes, if one of those three networks happened to be broadcasting a show for children at nighttime, you better believe that every kid has told all their friends at school, they're shouting it in the stairwells, they're talking about it on the playground, and everybody would be plunked down on their family room carpet or on their living room couch, and they were going to be there for that. It was appointment viewing, to be sure. So if you remember Charlie Brown Christmas, and who doesn't, in the first minute and a half of the show, it kind of sets the stage really, really nicely. The Peanuts gang, they're all skating on a frozen lake. It's nighttime. There's a Christmas song playing very softly. Charlie Brown and Linus aren't with the crowd. And that's kind of the way they are. They're both part of the group, and they're also apart from the group. So they leave a house through the back door, and they cross a snow-covered yard. Then they pass through the gates of a chain-link fence. And as Flanagan writes, they leave the realm of parents and they walk out into the night, which magically belongs to the children. The lights shine from the houses. The grown-ups are in the houses. They're creating, they're protecting the world of newspapers and breakfast tables and everything else. The children have their own work to do and they're left undisturbed to do it. And Charlie Brown and Linus, they walk over a really long distance. They've got their ice skates over their shoulders and they come to a little wall, and Charlie Brown rests his elbows on top of it. And then that's the first dialogue of the show. And Charlie Brown says to Linus, "I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel." I think a lot of people can identify with that. And by the way, we're still in the Christmas season. We're still in the Christmas season, and we're not through the 12 days of Christmas yet. And I know that we celebrated the Feast of the Epiphany on this past Sunday, even though, of course, in the liturgical calendar, it used to be always celebrated on the 6th of January. But we'll talk about the Epiphany in a little bit. But that's what Charlie Brown says to Linus. "Christmas is coming. I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel." And then he goes on to say, "I don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed. And as Caitlin Flanagan wrote, the call to adventure has now been issued, but it's an inside job. It's more of an inside job. It's like the interior journey, the interior adventure of Charlie Brown. Really, I think Charlie Brown should probably listen to The Inner Life with Josh Raymond on Relevant Radio. But and Flanagan says this is kind of the quintessential mid-century dilemma. Charlie Brown doesn't have to actually do anything. He's got to change the way that he feels. It's not like any other Christmas special that you might know of growing up. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had to leave his family. He had to escape death at the hands of the abominable snow monster. He had to then guide Santa's sleigh through a fog that was as thick as pea soup. The Grinch. I watched The Grinch this past Christmas. I made sure I watched The Grinch. The Grinch had to steal every Christmas tree and present and roast beast in Whoville, but then return them all at the end. Karen had to get Frosty the Snowman back to the North Pole before he melted, but Charlie Brown doesn't actually have to go anywhere. He doesn't actually have to do anything. All he has to do at Christmas is simply cheer up. And this is where the article got into the background of Charles Schulz, the creator of Charlie Brown. And I actually didn't know a lot of this stuff about him. He apparently had this deep respect for kids, and he really understood that the way that they think, the way they feel, not the way that adults want them to think or want them to feel. And he realized that there's some point in their life, even as kids, where Christmas kind of loses its magic a little bit. It doesn't quite work. And even kids can sometimes be very unhappy at Christmas time. So that's what he wanted to do. He kind of wanted to reassure them about Christmas, but he wanted to respect their intelligence. And he actually insisted. And a lot of the suits at the networks were really unhappy about this, but he said, I don't want there to be any laugh track in this cartoon, A Charlie Brown Christmas. And even to this day, a lot of sitcoms, they've got the canned laugh track. You know, I'm supposed to be laughing right now. This is supposed to be funny. He said, yeah, just like that. Just like that. We have to do that on our show a lot just to cue you. Yes, oh yeah, that was funny, allegedly. But Charles Schulz didn't want to do that. He said, look, if kids find something funny, they're going to laugh. You don't have to kind of force them along or help them with that. And he also insisted that all the actors who did the voices in A Charlie Brown Christmas actually be children reading these parts, a lot like the Merry Beggars did with their version of A Christmas Carol, which was so popular. And I really got to hand it to the Merry Beggars here on Relevant Radio. And I'm not saying this because I'm obviously part of the Relevant Radio family. I'm not saying this. This is not corporate speak. We really enjoyed that. If you did not listen to the audio drama, the radio drama of A Christmas Carol, you really missed out. It's not too late. It's still Christmas time. You can still check out the episodes on relevantradio.com, themerrybeggars.com. My daughter, Michaela, she could not wait to catch the next episode. Every day she would ask us, can I listen to The Merry Beggars now? Can I listen to Scrooge? I want to listen to A Christmas Carol. So she looked forward to that every day, and it was really well done. So Peter Atkinson, hats off to you, man. One of those top hats from Charles Dickens Day. Hats off to you, man. Great, great work with that, and I can't wait to see what you do next. So, just like Peter, Charles Schulz wanted to use actual children to read those parts. And another reason that Caitlin Flanagan pointed out in the Atlantic magazine why Charlie Brown Christmas is really, it just stands up. It absolutely stands the test of time because it's got this cool factor. And part of it has to do with the music. There was a producer by the name of Lee Mendelson, and he was actually trying to do a documentary on the life of Charles Schulz because obviously the popularity of the Peanuts was going through the roof. And he thought, wow, Schulz has really got his finger on the pulse of American life in the mid-20th century. And he thought, man, this guy's really, he's figured it out. So he found this single. It was actually a B-side, if you remember those, you know, actual records, actual vinyl. A lot of people are getting into vinyl again these days because the audio quality is so great. But remember, if you're old enough to remember buying an actual vinyl album, and not just an album, but actually you could buy singles of popular radio songs. And there's always the B-side, right? There's always another song on the flip side. And there was a B-side of a jazz single, and it was from an album called Impressions of Black Orpheus. The band was known as the Vince Guaraldi Trio. And if you have heard of this guy, you know that he became synonymous with all the Peanuts movies, all the Peanuts stuff on TV. His music was really the soundtrack of Peanuts. And so this producer, Lee Mendelson, found this song called Cast Your Fate to the Wind. Lucas, hit it. Play a little clip of this song, Cast Your Fate to the Wind. You can kind of get the picture, right? Get the audio picture. That sounds like Peanuts to you, right? Because his music, the Vince Guaraldi Trio, became synonymous with the Peanuts. So this documentary about Charles Schulz actually never got made. It never got made. But the producer, when he got called upon to help work on the animated special, Charlie Brown Christmas, he's like, you know what? I never got to use this jazz music, but I'm going to use it for Peanuts. I'm going to use it for a Charlie Brown Christmas. And that's really what makes the sound of the show so cool. So with respect to Charles Schulz's faith, this is something I didn't know. He grew up in the Midwest as a Lutheran, but it was kind of a nominal faith Charles Schulz had. But after the Second World War, he got a lot more serious about his faith. And when he came back from the war, and he actually returned to St. Paul, Minnesota. We have a lot of listeners from Relevant Radio in St. Paul, Minnesota. He actually switched churches, and he didn't become Catholic, sadly, but he did join the Fundamentalist Church of God. Now, they were a lot more rigorous than the sort of nominal Lutherans he had grown up with, and he got so zealous that he actually started preaching on street corners. He was kind of like a street evangelist. I did not know that about Charles Schulz. And all of this was kind of in the background. So when he made the Charlie Brown Christmas special, all the network executives said, we don't want any overt religion in the show whatsoever. But Charles Schulz was like, no, absolutely not. It's staying in. So all the suits thought, man, this show is going to flop. The ratings are going to be dismal. This is going to be terrible. But Charles Schulz wasn't thinking about the ratings. He was thinking about what is going to connect with these kids. And how can I explain to them something about God, something about the true meaning of Christmas? And of course, all the kids who first saw that special, they loved it. And it's become such a classic. Kids pass it on when they grow up and have their own families. They pass it on to their kids and so on and so on. And it's been out there for, you know, over one generation. And so really what it's all about is something that we all have to experience from time to time when it comes to Christmas. There's a character, and that's Charlie Brown, of course. He's completely disgusted with how Christmas has been commercialized. You might remember before the Christmas holidays, I told you about my interaction at the liquor store with this cashier who started going on and on. I wished her a Merry Christmas, and she just went on this rant about how she hates the commercialization of Christmas, and she just would not drop this. And that's exactly what's going on with Charlie Brown. But he's trying to figure out, what does this really mean? But he's looking in all the wrong places. There are the aluminum Christmas trees in the lot that he could buy. That's not going to do it for him. His sister Sally, his little sister, makes him write a letter to Santa on her behalf, which says, please note the size and color of each item and send as many as possible. If it seems too complicated, make it easy on yourself. Just send money. And then even Snoopy, of course, Snoopy has these elaborate lights and decorations on his doghouse, and Charlie Brown says, man, my own dog has gone commercial. And then so Charlie Brown's directing this Christmas play, and this is kind of the point of it all. He cries out, isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about? And that's when Linus steps forward and he says, sure, Charlie Brown, I can tell you what Christmas is all about. And he walks to the middle of the stage, calls for the lights, and he begins. Lucas, do you have a clip of this?
Lights, please. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
That is what Christmas is all about. And that was an incredible moment in television history. And as Caitlin Flanagan wrote about in The Atlantic, she said, quote, from the minute Linus starts talking, I feel like I'm holding my breath. It feels as though I'm being called back to something, as though finally I've been reunited with something elemental. It's ridiculous. It's television. It's corporate America. It's Coca-Cola. But fear not. On that empty stage, in that small boy's voice, it has a spellbinding power over me. And of course, Luke's gospel, as we know, it was written in Greek in the first century. And that version that Linus was reading from was from the King James Version. It was a 17th century English translation of the Bible. And then you heard that archaic language as Linus was reading that account from Luke's gospel, describing something that took place 1600 years before the King James Version was written. So why does it feel like, as Caitlin Flanagan writes, why does it feel like news from the front? End of quote. Like, yeah, it's just really powerful. And I just thought that was a really cool piece. And it reminded me of why that endured the test of time, A Charlie Brown Christmas, and the very surprising, very deep message of truth that it contains. Now we can find the gospel everywhere, can't we? You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We'll be right back after this message. If you want to call in and react, 888-914-9149. Be right back. Today's show is sponsored by Colby Academy. With more than 40 years of experience in Catholic home education, Colby Academy offers a blend of classical Catholic curriculum and the latest educational technology. More info at relevantradio.com/Colby.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's our first live show of 2022, and I want to talk to you. Give me a call, 1-888-914-9149, if you want to react to what we were talking about before. The hidden spiritual message, the interior journey of Charlie Brown in A Charlie Brown Christmas. Who would have thunk it? And producer Lucas, you were asking me before the break about Linus.
Well, his name came to me because isn't that the name of the Pope that succeeded St. Peter?
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know whether maybe that was a hidden Catholic message, you know, from the creator of the Peanuts, Charles Schulz. No, I don't think it was, but Linus, be so Catholic, cool. Be Catholic. Yeah, and
we should bring that name back. We should popularize Linus again. I think it's a good boy's name.
Hey, well, Linus. If you have a son one day, there you go. I'm going to hold you to that. Okay, Lucas yep. And Linus, right? So, but I was going to volunteer to be the godfather, but you can choose whoever you want. You can choose whoever you want.
Deal.
That sounds good. But no, you're right. You're right. And in fact, in Eucharistic prayer number one, which is also known as the Roman canon, which I think is really cool. It just sounds really cool. The Roman canon. Like you're shot out of the Roman canon. There are 12 early martyrs of the Catholic Church that are mentioned in Eucharistic prayer number one. And of course we have Linus, Cletus, Clement, Sixtus, Cornelius, and it goes on and on. And so, yeah, he was the successor of St. Peter. And how about that? How about that?
Another faith
did he carry
catching.
A blanket around cool. with him? Probably not, but, but yeah, so that's, so yeah, that was, I really enjoyed that story by Caitlin Flanagan in The Atlantic about the interior journey of Charlie Brown, the spiritual journey. Well, you know who else was on a journey? Of course, it was the Magi, the wise men. And this past Sunday, just yesterday, we celebrated the Feast of the Epiphany. And of course, the word Epiphany means really divine manifestation, of course. It's the manifestation of Christ to the nations as represented by, of course, the wise men. But it also could be translated as shining forth. And I really like this because I was watching a homily by Cardinal Collins, Cardinal Thomas Collins of Toronto, a great friend of the program. He was preaching on this at the Cathedral of St. Michael in downtown Toronto on this feast day just yesterday. And he was saying another way to interpret the word epiphany or to translate would be as a shining forth. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that because one of the things he said was that, look, the Catholic Church is not a secret club. Okay, this isn't, you know, my precious, you know, like Lord of the Rings. You know, he always says that because he's a big Lord of the Rings fan. And, well, something else, a little surprise for you about Lord of the Rings later in the program, but Cardinal Collins is always talking about my precious, you know, like Gollum with the ring. And yeah, it's not something that we kind of hide and keep to ourselves in our little group and it kind of dies with us. We've got to spread it. And he talked about on the Easter Vigil, how with the Easter candle, everybody lights their own little mini candle in the church during the Easter Vigil. And it just, as the light spreads, it just gets brighter and brighter and brighter and really illuminates the whole building. And that's what our faith is supposed to do. It's supposed to illuminate. It's supposed to provide guidance for the people around us, guide them to Christ, the light of the world. So it's not a secret club. And this is really the manifestation of Christ to the nations was part of God's plan all along. And that's really what the word Catholic means. And it comes from a Greek term, kata holos, which means according to the whole. It also means universal. It also means universal. It's a universal Catholic Church, but it can also be translated as according to the whole, as in, as Cardinal Collins said, I ate the whole thing. I ate the whole enchilada. We often say that. And Patrick Madrid might say he ate the whole taco, but you get the picture. You get the picture. The Catholic faith is not a buffet where you can get to pick and choose what you want to eat, what you want to consume, what you want to incorporate into your life, and you kind of throw the rest back. Especially if somebody sneezed on it, you know, in these days of COVID, we don't like the buffets. But no, we've got to take the entire body of teaching of Christ and incorporate it into our lives. That's what we've got to do. This is what Justin Martyr said in the early second century. One of the great catechists, one of the great apostles, one of the great defenders of the faith, apologists, one of the earliest apologists of the faith, when he said that we only let people consume the Eucharist who are A, baptized, who've received the washing for regeneration, as he calls it, and who believe everything that we teach. So when you say amen, when you come up to receive the Eucharist at Mass, you're not just saying, yes, I believe, amen, amen. I believe that this is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. You're also saying, I believe everything that the Catholic Church teaches in the name of God is the truth. And I accept the whole enchilada, if you will, the whole teaching block. So, and this is supposed to be shared with other people. And that's why, as Cardinal Collins said, there's a little song that people sing called This Little Light of Mine, I'm Going to Let It Shine. As simple as it is, you know, it's kind of a children's song in a lot of ways. It contains some pretty deep theology. And believe it or not, my wife and I actually used this as the recessional at our wedding as we were leaving, going out, This Little Light of Mine. That's what we sang. And because we wanted our marriage to be a way for people to find God in some small way. That the love that we share for one another might be a sign to the world of the love Christ has for his bride, the church, in some small way, a very dim reflection, but nonetheless, a reflection of that light. So that's really what Epiphany is all about. And if you read in Matthew chapter 2, it's got the account, of course, of the Magi looking for Jesus. It says, in just a few short verses here, just Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, it says, in the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage. When King Herod heard this, he was frightened and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, and you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the people of Judah, the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage. When they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. And so obviously, as you're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Obviously, Matthew's really comparing and contrasting the puppet king, the wicked king, Herod the Great, with the kind of kingship that Jesus provides. Jesus wants to save his people. Herod only wanted to use his people, and he would kill anybody who got in his way. And he even tried to kill, of course, the infant Christ. That's the slaughter of the innocents that we remembered just a couple of days ago. And so the fact that, you know, he was trying to kill Jesus from the very beginning, that helps to kind of focus on the fact that Jesus is going to the cross. That sets that up even at the beginning of the story of his life. And again, the kingship of Jesus is going to be a big theme there. When he's on trial before Pilate, he's tried as a king, the king of the Jews. This is the placard that's over his head on the cross. And so there's a lot of stuff that we can kind of learn from this. And by the way, when we talk about the Magi, there are a lot of people who try to say that these guys are not historical. There's no way this kind of thing could have happened. This is something that the gospel writer Matthew simply made up. It's not the case. We actually have a good historical basis for this. And by the way, the word Magi actually probably means that these guys are, in fact, magicians. That's where we get the word magic from. Now, it doesn't mean, by the way, it doesn't mean that these Magi were illusionists or, like, this isn't David Copperfield, right, or David Blaine's street magic. It's nothing like that. These are probably guys who were really astronomers, and they're probably from the Babylonian region, the Chaldeans. They might have even been priests. They might have even been pagan priests. And a lot of times in the ancient world, kings would actually hire these guys to be stargazers, to be kind of scholars, and their job was to kind of, okay, tell me what's going to happen next. They were kind of like doing horoscopes, I guess you could say, looking at the heavens. And the Chaldeans were really famous in the ancient world for that kind of stuff, for magic, for astrology. And it's also interesting, one of the readings for the Feast of the Epiphany, if you remember from yesterday, is Psalm 72. And Psalm 72 is really all about a son of David, the son of David, Solomon, King Solomon, the wise King Solomon. And what happens in Psalm 72? All of these kings from other nations bring gifts to the king of Israel. And so a lot of what's going on in the story of the Magi, the Epiphany, coming to see Jesus, that's actually a fulfillment of, this is typology at its very finest in the Bible. Something that happened in the Old Testament time is a foreshadowing of something much greater that's going to happen in the New Testament time, because God writes the world the way human writers write with words, the foreshadowing here. So the fact that kings brought gifts to Solomon, that's why, you know, the Christmas songs about the Epiphany, we three kings of Orient are, why do they call them kings in that song? Why do people think they're kings? It's because in Psalm 72, it's kings that bring gifts to the king of Israel. And that's how this tradition kind of got going, that the Magi were kings themselves. But they probably weren't. They probably weren't. But they were considered very wise. They knew stuff. from looking at the stars. They're kind of astronomers, as I said earlier. So they're looking for the Messiah. They're looking for the Jewish Messiah. And by the way, when they show up, they're asking around, hey, where do we find the King of the Jews? Where do we find the King of the Jews? Now, that title, this is what kind of freaked out King Herod, because he got that title. Herod was known as the King of the Jews. Herod's buddy, Mark Antony, remember Mark Antony, right? The lover of Cleopatra. Not Mark Anthony, guys. Not the salsa singer Mark Anthony. I need to know. Okay, no more karaoke. But so Mark Antony actually recommended to the Roman Senate, hey, why don't you call my buddy Herod the King of the Jews? So they're thinking, okay, Herod, this is great news. You've got a successor. Your kingdom is going to keep going here. And Herod's like, I don't want this to happen. I do not want this to happen at all. Herod at this point was getting pretty up there in age, and his mental state was really, really not good. He had lashed out, and he killed several family members. And in fact, he became so paranoid in his later years, he actually had this plan kind of in place that was supposed to go into motion as soon as he died. As soon as he died, a number of prominent citizens were supposed to be murdered at the very moment that he died. Now, why did he want to set that up? Well, he wanted to guarantee that the day he died would not be a celebration. Yay, Herod's dead. Man, what a party pooper. So he absolutely arranged for everybody else who was important to be killed the same day he died. So, wow, this guy is an absolute piece of work. He is a mess. So clearly, he is frightened when he hears about this. And by the way, just one other thing real quick I want to say about the star. The star. Did they really follow a star to where Jesus was born? Come on, this seems kind of crazy. Well, actually, even today, modern astronomers, okay, looking through the Hubble telescope and things like that, the modern astronomers will tell you there were actually celestial phenomena going on in the heavens that were happening at that time when Jesus was born. In the year 7 BC, there was actually an alignment of the planets, Jupiter and Saturn. And when they aligned, from Earth's perspective, looking up at that, that would have looked like a very, very bright star. Super unusual. Also, just a couple years after that, in the year 3 BC, Venus and Saturn did the same thing. They aligned in the heavens. And so there were a couple more. There was even a couple more that happened around this time. So that any of those things could have been what God used to show the Magi the way. And they might have been aware. If I don't know how much they knew about the Old Testament, but these Magi might have even known about the prophecy that's in the book of Numbers in the Old Testament. In Numbers 24:17, it says, this is a very famous messianic prophecy. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the borderlands of Moab and the territory of all the Shethites. So now that you say, well, okay, what does that have to do with the Messiah? A star shall come out of Jacob. But in the synagogues of that time, they use this paraphrase of the scriptures in the native language of Aramaic, which would have been the street language that Jesus spoke. In the Aramaic version of that passage, it says this, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. When the strong king from the house of Jacob shall rule, and the Messiah and the strong rod from Israel shall be anointed. So in the Aramaic version of this passage, Numbers 24:17, it clearly references a king and the Messiah. So, whoa. Don't forget also the Jewish historian Josephus talked about an oracle. There was some sort of a star or a comet in the heavens that incited his countrymen to revolt against the Romans, really kind of starting off this great Jewish war with the Romans. So if all this stuff was going on around 7 BC, 3 BC, all these signs in the heavens, then hold on here. This could have been what they saw, because don't forget, Jesus was born B.C., Jesus was born before Christ. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, the monk who got the calendar, we talked about this a little bit before Christmas, he got the dates wrong. So don't forget, Herod's still alive when Jesus is born. Herod died in 4 B.C. So Jesus was born slightly before Herod died. So maybe 5 B.C., something like that. So just before the death of Herod. One other thing that's kind of cool is that the ancients also thought, and so a lot of Jews thought this as well, that the stars were actually angels in disguise. Now that view kind of fell out of favor because the Second Catholic Council of Constantinople in the year 553 AD said that anybody who thinks that the heavenly bodies are living beings, that's a heresy. But in those times, people actually might have thought that, these are actually angels, the stars in the heavens, and leading them to the Christ. Kind of interesting stuff. Kind of interesting stuff here as we look at the Epiphany. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the program. By the way, that song is called Charlie Brown from Coldplay. Nice job, Lucas. I knew you could find that. I knew you would play that song at some point. So speaking of Charlie Brown, we're going to go to the phones right now. Jennifer is calling from Chicago. Hi, Jennifer.
There.
Hi. What's your thought?
Well, when you were talking about Charlie Brown, I had seen a Facebook feed, and I think it was from a Catholic website or okay. A Christian one, but this author pointed out, and I thought maybe it'd be the same author you were talking about with The Atlantic. This party pointed out that on that play, when Linus mm-hmm. recites Fear Not, he drops his blanket. And it was a very paradigm shift and cathartic for him and in the whole storyline with, you know, the coming of Christ and for him individually. And I thought it was really, really brought a tear to my eye.
Huh. That, you know, I never noticed that before. That's a good catch, Jennifer, because obviously that blanket for Linus is literally his security blanket. He carries it with him everywhere. So when he says, have no fear, he drops the blanket. It's like, okay, I'm putting my trust in God. I like that.
Yes. If only we had some sort of video on radio. But, I mean, yeah. I was, and she shows it. It had the little video clip on this clip that I saw on the Facebook feed, and I thought, wow, would you look at that? I never saw it before.
I'm so glad.
I didn't notice it before. But anyway, that's what's on my fertile mind this evening.
Well, I'm so glad you called in with that, Jennifer, because that's a detail that I completely missed the last time I saw it. So, and I watched it recently, and I hadn't seen it in probably decades, but I thought it was so cool and showed it to my daughter. It's just so nice to pass on to the next generation. But I'll see if it's
so
on
nice
YouTube.
To have wholesome entertainment that is appreciated through the years. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's something like for all ages. Everybody enjoys it.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, that's enough for me for now. But thank you for all the hard work you do for the Relevant Radio and. That's it for now. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, Jennifer, you're quite welcome. Call anytime. Thank you for your kind words. Really appreciate that. 888-914-9149 is the studio line to call the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We're going to go now to Carlo in Mount Prospect, Illinois. Hi, Carlo.
Hi, Cale.
Hey.
Glad to listen to your show. Great, great shows as usual.
Thank you.
I have some suggestion, I guess, for trying to figure out things that are a little mystical in the scriptures, mm-hmm. for example, the star. And I hope I'm not making too strong of a case, but, you know, throughout the homilies and that, there's a lot of speculation that we try to fill in the gaps of what was going on with the Holy mm-hmm. Family at times, because actually so little is written in the Gospels. There was a lot that was left out. And so I was wondering your opinion and just wanted to suggest that Private Revelation might fill in a lot of the gaps, at least in a human faith point of view and not like to be believed by the faith, by the faithful per se. But the one in particular was The Mystical City of God by Blessed Mary of Agreda. And the conversations that are mentioned between the Holy Family, that is just beautiful. It's so inspiring.
Interesting.
It really makes our my perspective of you know, Our Lady and Jesus and Joseph come 3D rather than you know, kind of like a 2D look from trying to imagine what life was like at the time. But the star in particular, this Blessed Mary of Agreda, mentions that it was a mystical star, that it was not part of the natural heavens, and that might explain, if that were true, that how it could lead them and then come to rest upon the house where the Holy Family was.
Well, Carlo, I want to jump in there. Thank you for sharing that. And this is a person who keeps coming up again and again. A lot of callers mentioned Blessed Mary of Agreda. I must admit I haven't read her works, but of course Private Revelation would not be, as you mentioned, Carlo, not binding on the faithful, only public revelation, Catholic revelation. We have to believe this is a, by nature, private. Having said that, though, obviously that could in fact be the case, that she's relating real things that happen in the life of Our Lady, Our Lord, Saint Joseph. And yeah, so there was this thought in the early church that there was actually a book. It's not part of the Bible, but it was called the Arabic Gospel of the Savior. Okay, so again, it's not a biblical book. It's not considered divine revelation. But in that book, it says that the Magi, what appeared to them was in fact an angel in the form of a star, which guided them on their journey. So again, there was that later church council that condemned this idea that the heavenly bodies can be living beings, but the concept that it was a supernatural event and that God specifically was involved in it, guiding the Magi to their destination, is certainly was, I think, universally looked at and accepted as people were interpreting this passage. And I got to say also, just really quickly, not too long ago, we talked about the passing of Anne Rice, who had converted to Catholicism, had actually been Catholic as a youth, left the church, came back, left again. She passed away recently. She wrote this fictional book about the early days of the Holy Family in Egypt called Christ the Lord Out of Egypt. I remember Father Rocky telling me that he loved that book. He actually read it 3 times. So, and that's not a private revelation by any stretch of the imagination, but an imaginative retelling of what it must have been like. And it's a holy way to use your imagination, I think, to imagine what would Jesus do in this situation as a young kid, or what was his everyday life like? Well, today is also an interesting day, I got to tell you, for producer Lucas, because he is really excited about this, and I'll tell you why. Today is the 130th birthday of J.R.R. Tolkien, of course, who wrote the famous classic, The Lord of the Rings, who helped C.S. Lewis to find Jesus Christ, part of the Inklings group. And there's actually a society called the Tolkien Society. And producer Lucas has alerted me to this, that today, this is what you are to do if you choose to partake, to celebrate J.R.R. Tolkien's 130th birthday today. Fans all over the world are invited to participate in a birthday toast. Now, this is tradition which comes from The Lord of the Rings, because in the book, after Bilbo leaves the Shire on his 111st birthday in The Lord of the Rings, Frodo, he sort of raises a toast to his uncle's birthday every year on the 22nd of September. So the society, the Tolkien Society, continues that tradition by toasting Tolkien's birthday. So he was born on the 3rd of January, 1892 in Bloemfontein. And here's how you do it. You just, at 9 p.m. local time, your local time, wherever you may be, you simply raise a glass, and here's the toast. All you have to do is say, "The Professor." You just raise your glass and say, "The Professor." So I think we've got time. Lucas, you want to crack one open here? Okay, here we go. I've got tonic water, because it's all I could find with a head of can that I could open. So that's my
Cheers.
Drink of choice. What do you have
professor,
there, Lucas?
I've got Diet Coke.
Okay, here we go. Ready? 1, 2, 3. The professor.
All right.
All right, we did it.
J.R.R. Tolkien. And I've got this really cool quote by Tolkien. as well, which shows just the Catholic gentleman that he was.
Oh, wow. Let's hear it.
He says this: "I put before you the one great thing to love on earth, the Blessed Sacrament. There you will find romance, glory, honor, fidelity, and the true way of all your loves on earth." So not only a great Catholic literary writer, but also a man of the church. He loved God. He was a family man. So cheers on this 130th birthday.
Cheers, the professor. So, hey, you're supposed to do it at 9 o'clock. It's 9 o'clock somewhere, Lucas. I know it. I know it. So, hey, why don't you tweet at me, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E Clark with an E, with a picture of how you toasted the professor. And we'll try to mention it on the show. So, man, I'll drink to that. I'll drink to that. Just tonic water, folks. Straight edger tonight. So, too much celebrating on the holidays. I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alog took your phone calls. I'm Cale Clark. We'll see you tomorrow. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.